Good morning. On today's programme, a diplomatic row between India and Bangladesh over a request to extradite a former Prime Minister. And the German city, which has taken a long road to become European capital of culture. But first we go to Turkey. The killing of an 8-year-old girl in the countryside last year became a national scandal there. It emerged that the people responsible were members of her own family. The trial of her killers has now concluded, but many are disappointed by its findings. From Turkey, Jasper Mortimer reports.
Thousands of children are reported missing every year in Turkey. But last year, one case stood out by far. An 8-year-old girl, Narin Guran, disappeared in August in a village in the southeastern province of Diyarbakir. 19 days later, special police officers flown in from Ankara found her body hidden in the undergrowth of a riverbank less than 2 kilometers from her home. Turks were shocked to learn that members of Narin's family and villagers had misled the search parties. The man who confessed to hiding her body, a local plasterer, had taken part in the search. Narin's uncle, who was the village headman, had steered the police towards a settlement of Syrian refugees. The uncle was arrested when he could not explain the presence of Narin's DNA on the seat of his car. Protests erupted across the country. Demonstrators carrying pictures of Narin's impish face accused the state of failing to protect children. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan declared he would take a personal interest in the case. 3 cabinet ministers came to Tavşantepe, an almost unknown village, to pay their respects at Narin's grave. Moving with unusual speed, prosecutors put 4 people on trial for murder: Narin's mother, Yüksel Guran, her uncle, Salim Guran, her elder brother, Enes, and the plasterer, Nevzat Bahtiyar. Cell phone records had found they were all in the family home at the time of Narin's death. Her father was out of town. In late December, again with unusual speed, the court delivered its verdict. The mother, uncle and brother were convicted of murder and sentenced to 30 years in prison. The plasterer was convicted of concealment of evidence and sentenced to 4.5 years. 10 days ago, the court published its written judgment, which revealed the judge's reasoning. And then people felt let down. While people welcomed the maximum sentences for the 3 family members, they were dismayed by the light sentence for Nevzat Bahtiyar, the man who hid Narin's body. The former head of the Diyarbakir Bar Association, Nahit Eren, said Nevzat should have been convicted of being an accessory to murder and received a much heavier sentence. Moreover, although the judgment ran to 944 pages, it did not reveal who the principal killer was, nor why Narin had been killed. When police examined Narin's brother Enes, they found he had bite marks on his arm and bruises on his face. These could not be forensically linked to Narin, but the court found Enes's explanation for them to be totally unconvincing. A Diyarbakir lawyer who followed the case, Mehdi Özdemir, told the press that because the police realized that the family had done it 19 days afterwards, the mother, uncle and brother had had lots of time to clean the house of evidence. As to why it happened, the judgment quoted Nevzat as saying that Salim, the uncle, had told him that Narin had seen him having sex with her mother. However, Nevzat changed his story several times. The judges decided this was not the reason, but they admitted they had not found the real reason. The judges castigated the mother, Yüksel, for failing to protect Narin. She testified she was at home the whole day and did not see anything amiss. But Nevzat testified that as he carried Narin's corpse out of the house, he noticed Yüksel watching him and crying. A newspaper columnist said the Narin affair showed the culture of Tavşantepe was, quote, detached from morality. And this otherworldly mentality emerged during the trial. A relative called Hüseyin Guran stood up in court and threatened to kill the mothers and wives of those who were defaming the family. The judge ordered the police to clear the court and adjourned the hearing. Liberal Turks want to expunge this culture from their society, and for that reason, they are disappointed that the court failed to get to the bottom of this case. This is Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Ankara.
Next, we go to India, which is refusing to comply with a formal request from Bangladesh to extradite former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina from New Delhi. Hasina fled to India during the massive student-led protests against her regime last year. Dhaka is mounting pressure on the Indian government to send back Hasina to face trial for her crimes. Leading the Bangladeshi charge is Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus, the country's interim prime minister and a widely respected figure who Hasina aggressively targeted during her autocratic rule. Sajida Momin has this report from India.
Bangladesh is a predominantly Muslim country in South Asia, ranked number 8 in the world by population. 6 months ago, Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus was given the responsibility of governing Bangladesh by students whose rebellion against Sheikh Hasina, the Islamic country's longest-serving prime minister, forced her to pack her bags and flee across the border to India in August. If she had not fled in the nick of time, some say with the help of the army chief, General Waqaruzzaman, who is her relative, Hasina would have been lynched by mobs which stormed her official residence soon after her helicopter took off. The fall of 77-year-old Hasina, a power-hungry dictator who ruled over Bangladesh with an iron hand since 2009, swept Yunus, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006, center stage as the interim prime minister. The irony is that Hasina was gunning for Yunus for years and was determined to see him rot in jail on trumped-up charges of financial impropriety. But he escaped prison not because Hasina had second thoughts, but because former United States President Bill Clinton and dozens of Nobel laureates warned her in writing not to harass him. Now the tables have turned. Hasina is a fugitive in India, and Yunus is in command steering his country. As Bangladesh slowly picks up the pieces following the students-led uprising, the 84-year-old renowned economist has a lot on his plate. But one of his top priorities is to bring Hasina back to Bangladesh to stand trial in hundreds of criminal cases instituted against her after she was toppled. She's accused of torturing and killing protesters and her critics, besides amassing a fortune through corruption, favoritism, and nepotism, and stashing her ill-begotten wealth in the United States, United Kingdom, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Singapore. Yunus has locked horns with India over her repatriation, as New Delhi has given her asylum to repay the countless favors she bestowed on India when she was at the helm for 15 long years. Hasina did whatever India commanded. In turn, India backed her fully, engaging only with her and her Awami League party, contemptuously ignoring opposition parties and leaders. Essentially, India is so obliged to her that sending her back is out of the question. In that sense, Dhaka is up against a wall. Nonetheless, the ongoing diplomatic tug of war between Big Brother India, the world's most populated country and a regional economic powerhouse, and a newly assertive Bangladesh over Hasina is being closely watched in South Asian capitals. When India's Foreign Secretary, Vikram Misri, called on Yunus in Dhaka in December, the interim Prime Minister is believed to have suddenly stood up and pleaded before India's top diplomat with folded hands to send Hasina back to stand trial for the countless crimes she has allegedly committed, putting the suave and charming Misri in a rather awkward position. After informally demanding Hasina's extradition, Dhaka recently sent a formal diplomatic communication to India seeking her return to the country for judicial process, as the Bangladeshi Foreign Ministry note put it. New Delhi has openly acknowledged receiving the Bangladeshi request, but hasn't said a word more. Besides her extradition, Dhaka is insisting that New Delhi shouldn't allow Hasina to mount attacks on the interim administration in Bangladesh from Indian soil. Dhaka's position is that while India can take its time to process the extradition request, it must bar Hasina from firing salvo after salvo at Yunus and his team. So far, New Delhi has showed no signs of silencing Hasina, let alone repatriating her, although Bangladesh and India have a comprehensive extradition treaty in place for dealing with each other's wanted people. Importantly, Dhaka has cancelled Hasina's passport and has written to Interpol to issue a red corner notice to all countries to arrest her and send her back to Bangladesh if they catch her. Hasina came to India at short notice for what India thought was going to be a short stay before she sought political asylum in the United States or the United Kingdom. Hasina has, however, managed to prolong her presence in India by citing threats to her life from jihadi forces she claims to have battled at India's behest. But if India decides to harbour Hasina indefinitely, the prospects of stabilising India-Bangladesh relations, which are in free fall, is certainly bleak, because Yunus clearly won't give up the chase. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Finally, we go to Germany. This year, the city of Chemnitz has the accolade of the European Capital of Culture. In 1990, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of Germany, Chemnitz reclaimed its original name from Karl Marxstadt following a referendum of its citizens. Today, it is a thriving city, but it has been a long road from 1989 to 2025, as Joan Scales now reports.
The long, hard road included the loss of thousands of young people to the west as the gates opened to better opportunities. The city's population fell from 315,000 to 240,000 in 35 years, a drop of 20%. It's hard to believe that at the beginning of the 20th century, Chemnitz was the richest city in Germany and was known as the Manchester of Saxony. Its success began in the 19th century with the establishment of many heavy industries, such as smelting, car and engine making, machinery manufacturing, and military armaments. Saxony, rich in mines for silver, tin, cobalt, iron, kaolin, and uranium, provided the essential raw materials for industries to grow. This led to the city being heavily bombed during World War II, when more than 40% of it was destroyed. For the European Capital of Culture, around 100 projects and 1,000 events can be experienced. Under the motto, See the Unseen, Chemnitz is making previously unseen places and people visible. They include many industrial-age buildings, museums and monuments. The Chemnitz Industrial Museum is an anchor point of the ERIH, the European Route of Industrial Heritage. It is a fascinating museum, charting the growth of industry and gorily showing the body of the first recorded industrial accident. The Purple Path Art and Sculpture Trail will showcase works by renowned international, national and Saxon artists. The exhibition in public spaces will tell the story of people, craftsmanship and industry, and it will also connect Chemnitz and the surrounding municipalities. Gunzenhausen Museum, named after its collector, comprised of nearly 2,500 works of German art from the turn of the century, Expressionism and post-war modernism, including one of the world's largest Otto Dix collections. #3000Garages is an artistic project. It will tell the story of Chemnitz's almost 30,000 garages built during the GDR era and tell their stories as living archives and creative spaces. The region of Zwickau, Central Saxony and the Ore Mountains will be part of the celebrations, with visitors encouraged to travel beyond the city and explore Saxony. The Ore Mountains mining region made it an economic stronghold and it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site since 2019. The ancient mining town of Schneeberg has become a centre of arts and crafts in the region, with lace making, leatherwork, wood crafts and pewter work. Many of these crafts grew out of the mining tradition. Motor fans will enjoy seeing the enormous August Horsch Automobile Museum that covers the early history of Horsch and Audi. The factory played a role in the manufacturing of the Trabant during the Cold War era, and you can see a variety of the utilitarian cars here. Other events during Chemnitz 2025 will include music, dance, theatre, talks, art, projects, collaborations, photography, community events, urban culture, fashion, festivals and singing across borders. Today, Chemnitz is a thriving city, and evidence of this is all around, with new buildings springing up and old ones being renovated or replaced. It is a walkable city with bright and amusing street art, good shopping and street markets laden with local produce. The leafy public areas along the river provide outdoor spaces to enjoy. It's a far cry from the old GDR days. The activities for Chemnitz, the European Capital of Culture, began on the 18th of January 2025, and I think we can say, yes, the citizens of Chemnitz are ready and happy to take the stage at this major European event. This is Joan Scales in Chemnitz, Germany, for World Report.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.